Weird Music for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. We love that music. And yeah. It captures the spirit of what we're about to do. Jimmy, go
ahead. And in keeping with the weirdness of the music, the lyrics are purely telepathic, so you can only think them, you can't speak them.
Yeah, that's right. So sing along mentally if you can. If you can produce mental the theremin sounds.
The lyrics are in mentalese.
Yes, right. But I heard you singing along, Jimmy. You sounded great.
Thank you.
Right there. You have a very nice mentalese voice.
Thank you. I see you've been attending those psychic development classes.
Oh, yeah. I've been working hard on that. All right. Weird questions for Jimmy Akin, because Jimmy really likes weird stuff and mysterious stuff and more unusual. Let's put it that way. The more unusual is always welcome with Jimmy. So people know, they go, as a matter of fact, Jimmy, and I've told you this before, and I'll say it again. Mm-hmm. We get the call. You're the only apologist where we get the call and the person goes, and the guests will say it. Other apologists from Catholic Answers will say it. That's a Jimmy Akin question, because it has an alien in it, or it has a robot in it, or it has, you know, and so we don't have any other category, but there is a category of that's a Jimmy Akin question. So,
I'm honored.
All these questions came to us via the internet. Jimmy, you put out the call for them. Some of this is folks responding to your call for weird questions.
Yeah.
And it got good and weird. So here we go. Marie asks this. My son Peter, who is 9, asked, when you're judged, what age are you? Is it Thomas's Aquinas opinion that we are 33 in the resurrection? Does that mean we will be judged at the age of 33? Thanks for your shows.
Well, we're going to be judged based on everything we did in our life. So if we live to be 90, we'll be judged on all of the things that we did in our life. And we will be 90 or more years old at that point. I mean, if you're 90 and that's when Jesus comes back, well, you'll be 90 years old when you're judged. On the other hand, let's say you die at the age of 90 and Jesus doesn't come back for, let's say, 400 years. Well, in that case, you will actually be 490 when you're judged. The question that I think Peter may be wondering about, though, is what physical age will your body appear to be in the resurrection? And the standard opinion, and this is an opinion rather than a church teaching, but the standard opinion is that in the resurrection, the blessed, you know, the saints, will neither have the defects of youth nor the defects of old age, because we won't have defects. And so we won't, you know, have bodies that are not yet mature, and we won't have bodies that have begun to become decrepit. So we'll have bodies that are perfect. And in trying to estimate, what age would that be on average? St. Thomas Aquinas estimated it would be around 32 to 33 years old. And so that was his estimation. Others have been even more zeroed in on the number 33, because it's often assumed that that's the age Jesus was. And so like, well, if that's when he died, you know, that's good enough for me. So so we'll be 33 as well. Actually, Jesus was more like 35 when he died, because he wasn't born. He was crucified in AD 33, but he was born in 2 or 3 BC. And so there's a little extra time in there. So he was more like 34, 35, 35 and a half years old at that point. But all we can really say for sure is that the blessed won't have either the defects of youth or the defects of old age. That seems to be the most certain thing we could say. When it comes to the lost, all bets are off. They may have defects. But when it comes to the saints, we will be able to have bodies, at least this is a standard opinion, we will be able to have bodies that are perfect. However, it may be more complex than that. My suspicion is that we'll be able to appear whatever age we want. And so now whether that happened, whether that will happen at the moment of judgment, I don't know. But after we've been judged and after we're in a heavenly state, I suspect we'll be able to take on different ages depending on, you know, what we choose to do, and maybe even different forms. So I wouldn't assume that we will have one and just one appearance in the resurrection.
Thank you very much, Marie and Peter, for that question. Appreciate it. It's weird Easter questions for Jimmy Akin. And next comes from Brian. It's a very brief question, Jimmy. You will have to make of it what you will. Bleeding tears? Question mark. That's aliens.
Well, I assume what Brian's referring to here is the passage in Luke's gospel during the passion narrative where Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane and he sweats blood. And I mean, he's sweating, and Luke tells us that his sweat became as blood. And so that's not something humans normally have happen to them. I should mention that this verse is not found in some manuscripts. And so there's a question about whether it was originally in Luke's gospel or whether it's something that got added later. But assuming it was in Luke's gospel, it wouldn't require aliens, because human nature can actually produce this effect. It's a known medical condition. It is known as hematidrosis. Hema is the Greek word for blood, and hydrosis is Greek for sweat. And so hematidrosis is bloody sweat, and it is actual blood that gets in your sweat. What happens is we have our sweat glands are connected in our skin, are connected to our blood supply, because they need to get nutrients just like every other part of our body, except for like bone cells and so forth. You know, they need nutrients to stay alive. And to do their job, like producing sweat. And so they're hooked up to our blood supply, and sometimes our blood goes through little bitty blood vessels called capillaries. And what can happen is those capillaries can get broken, and then the blood goes places it's not meant to go, like into the sweat gland. And so we can get blood in our sweat glands, which will produce bloody sweat. And this will happen sometimes when people are in conditions of extreme stress. Extreme stress or trauma is known to be one of the factors that can cause someone to experience hematidrosis. And so given the anguish that Jesus is experiencing in the Garden of Gethsemane, you know, he's death averse, just like all of us are, because God built death aversion into our nature to help keep us alive. The stress may have been so extreme for Jesus that it induced hematidrosis, and he did get blood in his sweat glands and bleed bloody sweat bloody sweat.
Brian, thank you. Lots more weird Easter questions coming up with Jimmy Akin right after this.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting support provided by Homeschool Connections. Homeschool Connections hosts the Catholic Homeschool Conference. The 2022 Catholic Homeschool Conference is June 10th through 11th, and the website is CatholicHomeschoolConference.com. That's CatholicHomeschoolConference.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Underwriting by Great Catholic Music.
Great Catholic Music, your one-of-a-kind streaming platform for traditional Catholic hymns and contemporary favorites 24 hours a day. Music that soothes the soul, that's safe for the whole family to listen to. What a relief. Great Catholic Music. Download the free mobile app or listen on any Alexa-enabled device or write from your PC or tablet at greatcatholicmusic.com. Great Catholic Music. Melodies for the soul.
EWTN has just increased my faith so much. I am a cradle Catholic, and I thought I knew my faith very well. But when Mother Angelica passed away and it was so much in the news, I learned all about EWTN and started listening all the time. And my eyes have been opened to my faith so much.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
Weird music, because it's Weird Easter Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Lots of weird questions to come. This one comes from Anita. Anita, I sense some consternation in her question, but maybe not, but that's how I'm going to read it. What does the Easter Bunny have to do with it? And why does he deliver eggs when bunnies don't lay eggs? My granddaughter asked me that the other day. Is the Easter Bunny perhaps an alien? Do all the questions end with the word alien, Jimmy, because it's for you?
No, they don't.
Okay.
No, they don't. So I don't think there's any realistic chance that the Easter Bunny is an alien. However, because I don't think there's any realistic chance that the Easter Bunny has positive ontological status, meaning
he doesn't exist.
Don't think he's real. Having said that, the reason that the Easter Bunny and Easter eggs are associated with Easter is because Easter occurs in the springtime. It's tied to what's known as the Paschal full moon, and the Paschal full moon is the is a full moon that's associated with the spring equinox. The equinox is where day and night are of equal length. That's why it's called equinox. Equal night, or nox is night, equa is equal. So when the night is equal to the day in length, that's when you have the equinox, the equal night. And one of those occurs in the spring, and one of those equinoxes occurs in the fall. And since Easter is tied to the spring equinox, it always occurs in the spring. So what animals are around in the spring? Well, rabbits are. Rabbits, of course, are around all year round, but they some of them are easier to see in the spring because they will change color. In some of them will change color in the winter when the snows come. Because if you're, let's say you're a brown hare, you know, you're a brown bunny, and the ground has suddenly turned white, that makes it very easy for all the predators to see you. And so your rabbits, various breeds have evolved so that they lose their brown coat and grow a white one for the winter. And then they regrow. Now, you have the reverse problem in spring. When the ground is all green and you're a white bunny,
yeah,
you're going to stand out. And so they lose their white winter coat and gain a brown or other colored one to help them blend in with the greens and the browns of the earth and the woods and so forth to make it easier for them to avoid predators. Also, they breed like rabbits, and they've got breeding going on in the spring. And so they're a symbol of fertility because they have these, you know, super huge litters of rabbit pups and so forth. And so they're a symbol of fertility, and spring is a time when nature is being very fertile. The flowers are blooming, the plants are growing, the animals are giving birth and so forth. And so it's natural to have rabbits as a springtime symbol. Same thing with eggs. Eggs also are a symbol of fertility. You know, the chickens lay them. It's how chickens reproduce and other birds. So they're also a fertility symbol. And there's a connection that eggs have to Lent, because traditionally in a lot of Christian places, you didn't just abstain from meat on Good Friday and Lent. You abstained from meat and all animal products, including eggs, for all of Lent. And so what would happen is you'd get a lot of eggs by the end of Lent, because chickens don't care if it's Lent or not. They're going to keep laying. And so because eggs last a surprisingly long time, they will stay good a surprisingly long time, even without refrigeration, if they're not pasteurized, they will stay good for a long period of time. And so by the end of Lent, people had all these eggs that the chickens had been laying all through Lent and they hadn't been able to eat. And then come Easter, now you get to eat all these eggs and you get to celebrate. And so that's the origin of the Easter egg, because now suddenly you could use all these eggs again, and people would decorate them to have a party and make it fancy and stuff. But that's how eggs became associated with Easter as well. And so because of the springtime associations of rabbits and the Lenten and Easter associations of eggs, that's how we got the Easter Bunny delivering eggs for Easter. It was a nice story that parents could tell their children and make a game out of it. And now we all get to have these eggs, which we can pretend were brought by the Easter Bunny. Incidentally, it's not the Easter Bunny in all cultures. In Germany, if I'm not mistaken, they have an Easter fox. But that's just one more cultural variation.
Anita, thank you for that question. I hope that that was helpful to you. It is not aliens. Rex is next. Very simple question from Rex, Jimmy. How much did that stone weigh anyways? It was very large.
So I assume we're talking about the stone, since this is an Easter-related question, I assume right. We're talking about the stone against that was rolled up against the door of Christ's tomb to secure it. Well, we can estimate this. I mean, obviously we don't know, but, you know, I try to take every question seriously and do what I can with it. So, well, what rock type would it probably have been made out of? Given the geology in the Jerusalem area, limestone is a good bet. And we actually have some confirmation for that, because if you go to the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem today and you look at Jesus's tomb, what you're going to see is marble. Because over the centuries, in order to honor and protect Jesus's tomb, they've covered it in marble. But occasionally they have to do renovations and stuff, and they will take off the marble and in order to do the renovations. And when you do that, if you take off the marble, you find it's limestone. And so probably the stone that was rolled against its mouth would have been limestone. Now, limestone comes in different densities, but a medium density limestone is going to weigh about 150 pounds per cubic foot. So if you have a block of limestone, it's 1 foot thick, 1 foot tall, and 1 foot wide, it's going to weigh about 150 pounds. So then we need to estimate how big was the stone. Well, it needed to be big enough to cover the mouth of the tomb. So how big was the mouth? Well, it couldn't have been too big, because Peter had to stoop down in order to enter it. That's something that John's gospel relates. When Peter and John race to the tomb, Peter has to stoop down and go in. So it wouldn't have been as tall as the entrance would not have been as tall as a typical first century resident of Roman Palestine. And because of the different nutrition in their day, they weren't quite as tall as we are. Maybe Peter would have been between 5 and 5.5 feet. So if he had to stoop down to enter the tomb, let's just estimate that the tomb height was 4 feet tall. And so that gives us a good estimate of how tall the stone was. Assuming it was circular, because it needed to be rolled into place or out of place, we can estimate it as a circle with a 4 foot diameter. So it would be tall enough to cover the entrance. And if it's a circle with a 4 foot diameter, that means it has a 2 foot radius. You know, the distance from the center of the circle to the edge would have been 2 feet. And that lets us calculate the surface area of the stone by the standard pi times radius squared formula that we all remember from math class in school, don't we, Psychelet?
I do. Strangely enough, I do actually remember that one.
There you go.
We'll
do the
you.
Quadratic equation later.
Okay.
So we take pi, that's 3.141596 and so forth, and we take the radius and square it. So if this is a 4 foot diameter circle with a 2 foot radius, 2 squared is 4, so it's 4 times pi. You do the math, and it turns out that the surface area of the front of the stone would be approximately 12.6 feet, square feet. But we need to make it cubic feet in order to do the weight calculation. So we need to also estimate how thick was this stone. And we don't really know, but for sake of simplicity, let's just call it 1 foot. Let's assume it was 1 foot thick. That would mean that the stone would fill 2.6 cubic feet. And if you have 2.6 cubic feet at 150 pounds per cubic foot, that means the stone is going to end up weighing a little bit less than 1,900 pounds. So there you go. Call it 1,900 pounds plus or minus some percentage. But that would be a good mid-range estimate for how much the stone would have weighed, a little bit less than a ton.
Rex, if you're not satisfied with that answer, I don't know that you're going to get a satisfactory answer. Thanks very much for that question. It's weird Easter questions for Jimmy Akin this hour, and we've got a whole bunch more of those weird questions here. This one comes from Father Jeff. Father Jeff asks, what if time travelers went back and succeeded in preventing the crucifixion? Mind you, I think that time travelers would be unable to change the past, even if time travel turns out to be possible. Would all those prophecies go unfulfilled? Would God have a backup plan of redemption in place?
So let's deal with the first thing. Could time travelers prevent the crucifixion? Not in our timeline, because our timeline exists, and we know that for a fact because we're in it. And one of the things that medieval philosophers pointed out is, from God's perspective in the eternal now, the past cannot be undone. Because if, you know, God cannot rewrite the past. This was one of the few things that was recognized as logically contradictory, and so God cannot do it. This is beyond the power of omnipotence, because it's nonsense to say that that once a moment exists in from God's perspective, that that moment could cease to exist. So, you know, one way of illustrating this is, well, okay, suppose God creates a moment in time where the crucifixion occurs. Could even God change that moment? Well, no, because in order to change the moment, that would imply there's change on the part of God. There would have to be one moment where he creates the instant of history with the crucifixion. Then God would have to delete that moment. And then God would have to put a new moment in its place where the crucifixion does not happen. And that means God would have to pass through three moments. For God, there would have to be a moment of creation, a moment of deletion, and a moment of recreation. And since God is outside of time, he doesn't pass through moments. So there's no way for God to change history. What God could do, and the medievals did not recognize this because they didn't have the concept of a branching timeline, what God could do is also create additional moments that branch off of the original timeline. So he can have a parallel moment where, let's say, a day before the crucifixion, time travelers appear, and they do things that cause a branch of time to split off where different events occur, and Jesus doesn't end up dying on the cross. And if you want to, I mean, like Quentin Tarantino has these movies that kind of follow history up to a certain point, and then at the very last minute, they dramatically diverge.
Yeah.
So if you want to do the Quentin Tarantino version of this, you know, they actually, I guess, would get Jesus up on the cross. They've nailed him to the cross. And suddenly the commandos swoop in with a helicopter and they start using machine guns to get rid of the Roman centurions. And they get Jesus off the cross and do a medevac and start treating his wounds immediately and so forth. And so in this timeline, if God allowed it, you know, it's not physically impossible to do all those things. And so God, it's not beyond the power of God's omnipotence to create a timeline in which those things happen. We don't have any evidence for the existence of such a timeline. But to get to Father Jeff's second half of his question, what would have happened regarding all the prophecies? Well, prophecies can be fulfilled in more than one way. And so I would assume that in this alternate timeline, the prophecies were simply fulfilled in a different way. And would God have had a backup plan of redemption? Well, he doesn't need one because he knew what really would happen in our timeline. But if he has other timelines out there, then I would assume, I mean, he loves people in every timeline, and I would assume he's got another way of achieving the redemption. That could even involve Jesus dying. Because the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council, was already planning to execute him before they got Judas involved. And so if this plot fell apart, presumably the council would try again in some other way, and God would allow it to transpire so that his son would have given his life out of love for us.
Right back with more weird Easter questions.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Does the Church have too many rules? Join me, Dr. David Anders, as we answer your questions right here on Call to Communion, Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Questions with Jimmy Akin, one of our favorite features here at Catholic Answers Live. Every now and then we get to do weird questions with Jimmy Akin. Well, why not do weird questions specifically connected to the celebration of Easter? That's what we're doing today. And here's another one for you. Jimmy King asks this. Oh, by the way, King is very formal the way he addresses you. He addresses you with your full name. King says, Jimmy Akin.
That's not my full name.
Oh, well. Okay, so what is your full name, actually? Jimmy?
It's the one on my birth certificate.
You don't share your middle name? Is it Roscoe?
No.
Is it because it's Roscoe? But that would be a great name, wouldn't it? Jimmy Roscoe Akins? Akins. Why did I say Akins? Because I'm sorry,
okay.
Jimmy.
Your days are now numbered.
Oh, I'm in trouble now. Do you share your middle name or no? Is it top secret?
It's not particularly top secret, but I'm going to be enigmatic today.
Very
I've decided.
Good. All right. Well, King says, Jimmy Akin, apparently smaller breeds of rabbits live longer than larger ones. Given the known average lifespans of different sized known breeds of rabbits and the photographic evidence of Easter bunnies, I wasn't aware of that. Could you estimate the average lifespan of an Easter bunny?
Yeah, so I'm not surprised that smaller breeds of rabbit live longer, in part because they are smaller targets for the predators. However, there is also a principle that that is more general here. The bigger a living system is, assuming it's, I mean, I'm not talking about a plant, but the bigger a zoological living system is, the more parts it has to break and the easier it is to break. And actually, short people tend to have longer lives. I used to call contra dancing for a club for older people, and many of them were in their 70s and 80s, and some of them were even in their 90s. And I noticed everyone in this club is short. So there are some advantages. In any event, I'm not surprised that the same principle would apply to rabbits. And I did some checking, and so a typical rabbit will live for an average of 5 to 10 years, assuming they don't get, you know, taken by a predator. The longest lived rabbit on record was a wild rabbit that I guess was captured very young, presumably when it was a baby, so they knew how old it was. And it was named Flopsy, and Flopsy lived for 18 years.
You go, Flopsy.
But that is an outlier. So if we take the average as 5 to 10 years, and we take the Easter bunny, so 5 years would be for a larger rabbit. And if we take the Easter bunny as being approximately twice as tall as a large rabbit when standing on its hind legs, like you see in the Beatrix Potter books, we would need to take 5 years and reduce it by some factor. And I would suggest, as an estimate, just cutting it in half and saying, okay, a typical Easter bunny would live for 2 to 3 years. So they'd have a year to learn to grow up and learn their job. They would deliver eggs for a year or two, and then it would be time for the next Easter bunny to come hopping down the trail. Yeah, the bunny trail. And so so apparently we go through Easter bunnies rather fast, but it gives them a chance to have useful, productive careers.
King, I'm so glad you asked that question. Thank you very, very much. Now we know. Now we know. Tarian asks the following question. It's a little bit long. I heard a priest explain when Christ's body was in the grave, he went and preached to the spirits or souls in prison, mentioned, I believe, in 1st or 2nd Peter. He preached to the good dead, not the bad dead, those in true hell, as I understand it. Mel Gibson's upcoming Passion of the Christ 2 movie.
Hi, Si.
Oh, hi, Mel. It's nice to see you again. I didn't know you were going to be here. Let me finish reading this question, Mel. Thank you. Mel Gibson's upcoming Passion of the Christ 2 movie will be about this very subject. What say you, Jimmy, on this scripture in St. Peter's epistle?
So I unfortunately am not on a first name basis with Mel Gibson as you are, Si. So I'm not privy to what he's got in the script for the new movie, which is reportedly its working title is Passion of the Christ Resurrection. Mm-hmm. And so it might deal with what's called the harrowing of hell or the sanctifying of the netherworld. That's what harrowing of hell would mean. And it may well deal with that. Now, I can't really talk about that, but what I can talk about is the scripture involved. The particular scripture that Tarian is thinking of is 1 Peter 3, verses 17 to 19, which says this: For Christ also suffered once for sins, the just for the unjust, in order that he could bring you to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive in the spirit, in which he also went and proclaimed to the spirits in prison, who were formerly disobedient when the patience of God waited in the days of Noah while an ark was being constructed. Now, the way a lot of people read that, okay, so he's going and proclaiming the gospel to these spirits who had disobeyed, but there's some strangeness here. The first bit of strangeness to be aware of is that when the term spirit was used without a qualifier in this age, like his spirit, when just the bare term spirit in Greek pneumatos or pneuma was used, it tended to refer to a non-human spirit. Yes, humans have spirits, but if you talk about a spirit, you normally mean a non-human spirit, like an angelic one. And so that could raise a question about, are these spirits human? And I'll have more to say about that. But secondly, it's how do we understand this proclamation he's making? Presumably, he's proclaiming the truth about what he's done. But if these are human spirits, why would he be proclaiming the gospel to them? It's not like humans have a second chance after death. As we're told in the book of Hebrews, it is appointed for men once to die, and then comes judgment. So there's no second chance after death. So he wouldn't be proclaiming the gospel to these spirits for purposes of getting them to repent. Well, what else might he be doing? Well, if they were good spirits, if they were human spirits of the righteous dead, like, you know, King David and people like that, he could proclaim the gospel to them in the sense of, I have now come and fulfilled the prophecies. You are all redeemed. Pack your bags and let's go to heaven. Well, he could be meaning that, but then why is he doing that for the spirits who disobeyed? The spirits that disobeyed are presumably not people who are going to heaven. And specifically, why would it be the spirits who disobeyed during the period when the ark was being built? I mean, this would be, if it's, hi, I finally fulfilled the promises, we can all go to heaven now, that's a message for all of the righteous dead in the Old Testament, not specifically for spirits that disobeyed during the building of the ark. So is there other literature that we have from this period in history? It's known as the Second Temple period. Is there other literature we have from this period that that talks about spirits disobeying God in connection with the period when the ark was being built? And the answer is yes, we do. An example, but not the only example, is the book of First Enoch. And in the book of First Enoch, the thing that brings on the flood is a group of angels decide that they're going to leave heaven and come down to earth and marry human women and teach mankind forbidden sinful arts. And that's what corrupts the world so that God brings about the flood. And of course, he's got to wait for Noah to get the ark built. And so you have these spirits running around on earth causing problems while the ark is being built. And then when the flood comes, God dispatches angels to do different things. And one of the things he dispatches is, and it's like Gabriel and Michael and so forth. He dispatches one of them to take these spirits and put them in prison until the last day. And at the last day, these spirits will be taken out of prison and judged. And so this sounds kind of like what we've got going on here. We've got these spirits in prison who were formerly disobedient when the patience of God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being constructed. And now they're in the netherworld, and Jesus goes and essentially proclaims to them, your time's getting short, guys. Day of judgment's coming. So, you know, you're going to experience it just like it was promised. And then we have a couple of additional passages in Jude and 2 Peter that also seem to be referring to this same thing. In Jude 6, we read about the angels that did not keep their own position, but left their proper dwelling and have been kept by God in eternal chains in the deepest darkness until the judgment of the great day. So these are demons, they're fallen angels, but they're not running around on earth. They've already been chained up in anticipation of the last judgment. And it looks like Jude is referring to this same set of concepts. And then in 2 Peter, we have in 2 Peter 2:4, we have the statement, "For if God did not spare the angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed them to pits of deepest darkness to be kept until the judgment." And also, I should mention in 1 Enoch, it is like pits of darkness where they're confined. So it looks like we have Peter and Jude referring to this complex of things. Now, that doesn't mean Jesus didn't also preach to human spirits and announce to the righteous dead that they could go to heaven now. But in terms of what it looks like this passage is dealing with, to me, it seems the best bet is that's what it's referring to. It's referring to these formerly disobedient angelic spirits. Now, what that all means, and I should point out, there are other readings of that text, and it could be something else, but the convergence of the data, to my mind, suggests that's what Peter and Jude have in mind. And if you'd like more on that, and how to interpret that in terms of a modern worldview, I would suggest listening to episode 87 of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on the Nephilim, which is where we talk about this.
Thank you very much, Tarian, for that question. Appreciate it. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more weird Easter questions for Jimmy Akin right after this.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
One time somebody said to me, "Why don't you air these people?" And I said, "No, because I don't think they're Catholic." He says, "By what right do you have to say that?" I said, "I own the network."
Mother Angelica Live Classics, every morning, 2 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Weird questions with Jimmy Akin, but they're weird Easter questions this time because it's still Easter week, so we got quite a few more to get to. And Jimmy Akin, of course, is our guest. It'd be weird to do weird questions. That would be really weird, do weird questions with Jimmy Akin and have somebody else be the guest. This one comes from Father Matthew, two priests today.
I could be the one asking the questions.
Oh, weird.
And it would still be weird questions with Jimmy Akin. I'd just be the questioner instead of the answerer.
Occasionally you ask me weird questions. Mm-hmm. Occasionally you'll ask me a weird question.
Okay.
But actually, most of your questions for me are Bible questions.
Okay.
And you don't make them too tough. You're usually
right.
Not trying to embarrass me on air.
I'm not. I'm trying to, when I ask you questions on air, it's typically, I mean, unless we're just bantering, but if I'm asking you in the context of answering a question, if I'm asking you a question, it's to illustrate, it's to make the answer more interesting by involving, you know, another person. And it's to illustrate that this is a point of common knowledge. And helps.
Right.
It's not just I'm who is aware of this. This is, you could ask other people and they would be aware of this too. And that strengthens the point I'm making.
Right.
Because it shows you, you don't have to be some, you know, weirdo like I am to know the answer to this. This is a
even weirdos
common
like
answer.
I am.
Yeah.
All right. This is from Father Matthew. Oh, Max, I see what the question is now. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. It's a little gross, but how does undigested food affect the properties of resurrected bodies? For example, it's usually assumed resurrected bodies can walk through walls. But would a resurrected body that just ate be able to do so? I think the rule is don't walk through walls until a half hour after you've eaten. Isn't that? That's what my grandmother always told me. Oh, wait, no, that was about swimming. My bad. Sorry. When talking about the Eucharist, we often assume the real presence is there for about 15 minutes as it still has the accidental form of bread. Would a resurrected body need to wait 15 minutes after eating before walking through a wall?
Okay, so first thing, let's deal with the swimming bit. Because when... Yeah. Because when I was a kid, we'd go to the beach and then we'd have lunch and then they would want us to wait for an hour before we go in the water. And the ostensible reason for that is if you go in the water sooner than that, you can have cramps.
Yeah.
Total nonsense.
Yeah.
Your body does not have a reflex that causes cramps if your stomach is full. That there are other reflexes. Like, you know how when you get in the water and or you're taking a bath or something and your fingertips wrinkle up?
Yeah.
That's a reflex. That is not because of oil is going out of your skin. Oil is not going out of your skin. What happens is we have evolved. Now, the whole reason we as humans have fingerprints and toe prints, because we've also got toe prints, is to create additional friction when our fingertips, because we use our fingers to manipulate stuff, and we therefore want a good grip on those things. And so we've evolved fingerprints under God's providential design to give us a better grip. And because it creates additional friction. Well, okay, what happens when your fingers get wet? Well, that makes things more slippery. And so you have problems gripping things as well. And the same thing is true with the soles of your feet. You can't grip as well when it's wet. And so we've got a biological reflex that when our body senses our hands and our feet are wet, it makes them shrivel, the skin on them shrivel to create deeper ridges to contain that water and make more, give us more gripping power, both with our hands and our feet, so that we can steady ourselves and not slip and hurt ourselves.
Isn't that some?
Yeah. So we do have reflexes that are water-based, but causing your stomach to give you cramps is not one of them. So that's total nonsense. There is no scientific evidence for you need to stay out of water after you've eaten. That's just ridiculous. But so what about walking through walls? Well, the thing that stops you from walking through walls is the electromagnetic force, because atoms, you know, they've got a positively charged nucleus because they've got protons in there. And then they have a negatively charged set of outer shells. That's where the electrons are. Electrons are negatively charged. But Cy Kellett, if you have two magnets and you put them together with the north end of one magnet to the north end of the other magnet, will they attract or repel?
Repel.
That's right. They'll repel. And similarly,
50-50.
Similarly, the same charges repel. So if you have two positively charged things, they will repel each other. That's actually why they have neutrons in the middle of atoms. It's to separate the protons enough that they don't fly apart.
You got to keep them separated.
Yeah. It's kind of like two drunks in a bar. You got to keep them apart so they don't fight each other. Or, well, this is kind of the opposite of that. But if you have negatively charged electrons, they will repel other negatively charged electrons. And since you have the surface of your skin is made of atoms and atoms have electrons on the outside, if you go to touch a solid object where the atoms are arranged in, you know, in a tight, dense pattern, then the reason your hand doesn't go through, even though you and the wall are mostly empty space, is because the negative electrical charge in your skin is going to be repelled by the negative electrical charge in the wall. And that's why you can't go through walls, even though you and the wall are mostly empty space. So in order for Jesus to walk through a wall or anything else solid like this, something would have to happen. I mean, there are different ways of doing it. One way would be moving him slightly up in the fourth dimension so he goes over the matter but if he's actually going through the matter of the wall, then presumably something is happening with the electrical charge that allows him to move through it. Now, when we take food into our bodies, it eventually becomes part of us. But food you've just immediately added would not have done that yet. It'll still be in your digestive tract. It won't have been completely digested. It won't be part of your body yet. But I think that there is, I think that the logical explanation here is that there's really a field. I mean, assuming Jesus is physically going through the matter and not over it in the fourth dimension, there's something happening with an electrical field around Jesus's body that affects not only him, but his clothing. Because when he shows up, he's not naked. Yeah. And so, so it would appear that there's a field around Jesus that is changing the way the electromagnetic force operates, and that includes his clothing. And if it includes his clothing on the outside of his body, it should also include any food or oxygen on the inside of his body that he hasn't fully assimilated yet. And so I think that he would be able, after he eats the broiled fish, if he wants to walk through a wall, the broiled fish is going to go with him.
So it's just like swimming. You do not have to wait.
Yeah.
All right. Father Matthew, that was a great question. Thank you very much for that one. This one comes from Eric. What can we say in response to those History Channel types, who might ask, how can we be sure that Christ wasn't raised from the dead by a benevolent, sympathetic alien force that has been surreptitiously monitoring the human race?
So I think in a couple of ways. The first way is show me your evidence. You want to make that claim? If you want to change my opinion, you need to show me evidence to change my opinion. Simply making a claim like this does not provide me with evidence. So I would need to see evidence. And it would need to overcome the evidence I have. Now, a principle that I use in a lot of different fields is the person who's able to explain how he did something, the person who does something, is the best person to explain it under ordinary situations. For example, 100 years ago, Harry Houdini and Arthur Conan Doyle got into a big argument. Harry Houdini, of course, was a magician, and he would do magic tricks that would simulate supernatural phenomena, you know, like making something appear out of nowhere. Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, however, was a spiritualist, and he would insist to Houdini that Houdini was actually using paranormal abilities. And Houdini would say, no, I'm not. This is just a trick. And so I would say, well, Houdini's the one able to produce this effect. Houdini's the one who's best qualified to explain how it's being done.
Right.
So Jesus was the one who was who rose from the dead. He's the one who's qualified to tell us how he rose from the dead. And he said it was by the power of God, not by alien medical technology. So I'm going to go with the guy who's actually qualified to tell me how this was done and say Jesus was right. He rose from the dead by the power of God, not by alien medical technology. And if you want to convince me otherwise, you're going to need to show me some pretty serious evidence.
Eric is, however, right about the History Channel. There are a lot of aliens on there, but there's a lot of asserting that aliens are responsible for this or that on the History Channel.
Including by some people who have really weird hairdos.
I know. What's the deal with that? Like, the titles are fascinating, you know, like paranormal researcher or that just these kind of. What's the deal with the hairdos on the History Channel?
Well, there's the one guy in particular in the aliens meme. I'm not saying it's aliens, but it's aliens meme, who has a very interesting haircut.
Well, that does it for us. And, thank you very much. Happy Easter, Jimmy. And I hope you have a wonderful weekend, and we'll see you next week, where we can probably say Happy Easter again, because
it's still Easter.
It's Easter all the way up until the Feast of the Pentecost.
This
weekend, by the way, is Divine Mercy Sunday. If you don't know about Divine Mercy Sunday, but that's something you might be interested in, just take a look. Look it up on the internet, because God is merciful, and what he asks of us is to be merciful to one another. So it's a wonderful thing to be taken up in that mercy. Jimmy, thanks again. We'll see you next time.
My pleasure.
Catholic Answers Live.